Lee's office, we're looking at Senator Sanders' office and Senator Warren's office, all where we have families that are detained at Berks that have lived half of their lives as children in this jail, and we're going to ask them for action. And so the senators need to be aware that we are going to get action, and they need to step up and be champions for these families.
And you're picking these particular senators because there are folks detained who are from their states?
Absolutely. We have families that are from Boston. We have families that are from Vermont. We have families from California. These are offices that they're not doing what they are saying in the press that they're doing, that they stand behind these families. You know, words are great, but when you can introduce a private bill that will stop their deportation this very moment and you're refusing to do that, you know, people need to know.
Mohammed Abdullahi, we thank you for being with us. We will certainly follow what happens at that action at Senator Kaine's office. Dr. Alan Keller, thanks for being with us. And Bridget Cambria, immigration lawyer representing many of the families detained at the Berks County Residential Center in Pennsylvania. We'll do part two of our interview after the show and post it at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz, as well as Laura Gottesdiener. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are engineers. Also special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and John Hamilton. And to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gudars. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now! To see all of our transcripts, video, and audio podcasts, go to our website.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Institute for Anarchist Studies 20th Anniversary Celebration on Friday, September 9th at Audio Cinema in Portland. The Institute for Anarchist Studies is an organization that gives grants to radical writers, publishes the journal Perspectives on Anarchist Theory, and engages in educational activities. This event features Portland DJs Katie Pants and Nathan Carson and a performance by Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's the Institute for Anarchist Studies 20th Anniversary Celebration, Friday, September 9th, starting at 8 p.m. at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group, presenting astrophysicist Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Dr. Tyson will explore science as portrayed in pop culture, and tickets and information for his September 20th show are available at portland5.com. This program has also been made possible by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Bundy trial opened today. We'll take a first look.
Standing Rock protector Cody Hall talks about yesterday's split ruling on the Standing Rock Dakota Access Pipeline construction.
And the Black and Latino communities come together to demand police accountability this coming weekend. We'll speak to an organizer.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The trial of Ammon and Ryan Bundy and five other Malheur Wildlife Refuge occupiers began today in federal district court in Portland with Judge Anna Brown presiding. All seven defendants are charged with conspiracy to prevent federal employees from carrying out their duties. Some of the defendants are also charged with theft and carrying unauthorized weapons onto federal property. The trial is expected to take as much as 9 weeks, likely running into early November. While the public is not allowed into the courtroom where the trial is taking place, they can watch a live video feed in an adjacent room. 26 people involved with the occupation have been formally charged. Seven more are set to go on trial in early 2017.
Students from Lincoln High walked out of class today to protest plans to delay a vote on a $750 million construction bond until May. The walkout had been promised at last night's Portland Public Schools board meeting. Hundreds of students marched toward Pioneer Courthouse Square, then gathered in front of City Hall and spoke with Tara Pierce, Mayor Charlie Hale's chief of staff. For the bond measure to be included on November's general election ballot, the school board would need to approve the request no later than tomorrow. The measure would fund repairs to remake Lincoln, Benson, and Madison high schools and to make Kellogg Middle School safe enough so it can reopen as needed.
Over 130 campuses of the for-profit ITT Technical Institute in 39 states were closed today. The school was the subject of several state and federal investigations and was sued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in 2014. The company blamed the shutdown on the U.S. Department of Education's decision to ban ITT from enrolling new students who use federal financial aid. The closures are expected to affect about 35,000 students and cost over 8,000 people their jobs. Current students and those who left the school within the last 4 months will be eligible to have federal loans for their ITT education forgiven if they want to start over at another school.
School nurses are in dangerously short supply in Oregon. School nurses have many responsibilities, including emergency care of acute conditions, management of students with chronic conditions, school immunization programs, and health instruction. Yet many Oregon systems have limited or no nursing resources available. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has more.
A report issued today points to a critical shortage of school nurses in the Oregon public school system. The report, which was jointly issued by the Oregon School Employees Association, the Oregon School Nurses Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, and Upstream Public Health, noted that nearly half of school nursing positions were slashed between 2010 and 2015. Jason Cox of the OSEA pointed to some sobering statistics.
We'll get right to the point. Bottom line is Oregon needs to hire more school nurses. Between 2010 and 2015, we lost nearly half of our school nurse positions. So I'll briefly summarize some of the key findings. So Oregon schools have just one certified or licensed registered nurse for every 2,178 students. The recommendation from the National School Nurses Association is 1 to 750. 85 school districts have no registered nurse or school nurses at all. In 2009, Oregon passed a law requiring certain staffing levels to make sure kids with specific health needs had them met. 31 school districts in Oregon are currently in violation of this law. To meet the recommended ratio of one school nurse for every 750 students, Oregon would have to spend somewhere in the range of $58 and $72 million annually. There's a study showing that every dollar spent on school nurses provides $2.20 in benefits to society, saving later costs in publicly subsidized insurance and programs.
Jane Carlson, a secretary in the Malala School District, pointed out that teachers and secretaries are frequently handling the medical duties that should be handled by nurses.
In the Malala River School District, we have one registered school nurse that serves 3,600 students within a 250-square-mile radius of our school district, and it's really crazy when you think about that. Our nurse is amazing, but she can't be everywhere every day. She has certain staff, and it's generally the office staff that's trained. In my building, I'm trained, and my assistant is trained to check insulin levels, to know what to do if a student's having an asthma attack, and administering life-saving medications. And we're happy to do our part to make sure that our children are safe and healthy, but we have no formal medical training, and we shouldn't be put in this situation. This is legal in the state of Oregon. We actually work under the nurse's license.
In order to meet the ratio of one nurse to every 750 students that's encouraged by Oregon state law, the legislature would need to make an investment of $58 million per year. In order to achieve a level of one nurse for every school building, Oregon would need to invest $78 million per year. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
After St. Louis County, Missouri firefighters extinguished a burning car on the roadside, police found the body of 29-year-old activist Darren Seals inside. Seals had been killed by gunfire. A St. Louis resident, Seals was a leader of the protest movement following the fatal shooting of teenager Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson on August 9th of 2014. He was leading protests with the groups Hands Up United and organizing a campaign called Polls Over Police, seeking to use this year's elections to change police policy. Seals had recently uploaded a live video saying Ferguson police had drawn guns on him and also on his 14-year-old brother in July.
This Sunday, the Latino and African-American communities are joining hands for police accountability. The event is Black and Brown Lives Matter, Reflection, Outrage, and Atonement. Here with us live in Studio 2 is Francisco Lopez of the Voz Hispania Cambio Comunitario. Thank you for being here, Francisco.
Thank you for inviting me.
First off, what does the VHCC do?
Voz Hispana Cambio Comunitario, the translation will be Hispanic Voice for Community Change, is a grassroots organization, a nonprofit organization, co-founded by immigrants, documented and undocumented immigrants from Latin America. We are based in Woodburn, but we work with different core teams of immigrants, documented and undocumented in Salem, Albany, Hillsborough, Portland, the Gresham area, and Beaverton, and our job is to do leadership development, organizing, advocacy and issues. We also work on parenting education. We have a parenting education program. We have a youth program, leadership academy, and also we work on human rights issues in Mexico and Central America and the implications that have here. The other area is education and information about immigration. We are advocates for a legalization of our undocumented population here in Oregon and the United States. And also we work very close with the Latino inmates at the Oregon Department of Corrections. There are over almost 2,000 Latinos at Oregon correctional facilities. That's not including the city and county and federal jails. So it's a large number of Latinos, and most of them are from Mexico.
Wow, so that really spans a broad segment of the community there.
Yeah.
So how many people do you work with, and how big is the VHCC community?
Well, you know, we are three of us that we use a space in for free in an Episcopal church in Woodburn. There are three of us that work in different projects. Well, we have hundreds of volunteers. You know, we have at events where we have mobilized 500, 600 people. We are independent. We are not related or affiliated or even in relationship with any of the political parties. We don't receive funding from unions or any other organizations. We are receive most of our support comes from the faith community and the Latino community at large, the small businesses. We don't like government funding. We don't take it. And we don't get money from foundations that restrict our voice because, you know, we are working for freedom and equality, so we cannot be tied to the desires of others about their money.
So from your perspective, do you feel that social issues within the Black community are similar in ways to the issues that the Latino community is facing?
Oh, of course. You know, in the last 8 years, things have been getting worse and worse for Latinos and African Americans. And, you know, every time that you see that, you know, for example, in Oregon, Latinos and African Americans are overrepresented in jails and correctional facilities, you know there is a problem. And we have that common. So you have cells where one cell that is a Latino, the next cell, the neighbor is African American. And you see it in our community, well, we are interrelated. But the bigger problem here is we, Latinos and African Americans, have been the target of mass incarceration, mass deportation, mass separation of families, and of course, the topic, police brutality. Police do whatever they want. You know, you even, not just police brutality, people that have been murdered, killed around the country, but also the judicial system. If you and I commit the same crime and go to a court here, I will get a harsher sentence because of the color of my skin and my accent. You might get out of probation or more lenient sentence. And that's a fact here in Oregon. Sentencing guidelines are harsher if you are an immigrant, a Latino immigrant, have an accent, or you are Black. It's the color of our skin that makes us guilty here in Oregon and anywhere else in the country. So I think those are some of the social issues. And, you know, and let me talk about, you know, when I mentioned something, I was going with my kids to, you know, in Dallas, Mammoth, Independence, you know, looking for a, we wanted to do a hike. And suddenly we went through some small rundown houses in rural areas. There were a lot of Confederate flags all over. And we started wondering, my kids started asking, what are these Confederate flags? Well, that's a symbol of hate and white supremacy. But then my children asked me, well, that doesn't happen in Oregon. But I would tell you when we raised the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag is raised every time that we are poisoning with lead the water of children in the Portland School District, and we, in conspiracy, we don't want to say how that happened. Then we raise the that flag, the Confederate flag. We raise the Confederate flag when we let police to get away with anything. We raise the Confederate flag when even we cannot do anything about homeless people, and we keep putting them in boxes and cages and not to do anything about it. We raise the Confederate flag when we put more law enforcement, police protection in the Pearl District than Northeast Portland. We raise the Confederate flag every time that somebody has been displaced from, you know, neighborhoods, African-American Latinos that have lived all their lives. That's when we raise the Confederate flag. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. used to say, you know, one of his most famous letters or speeches, well, letters, was when he was in the Birmingham jail. The Birmingham jail said that the biggest stumbling block for the freedom of people of color were not the KKK or the Knights Council, but he said the white moderate, because they prefer order than justice. People here in Portland get upset when Don't Shoot Portland and others, we take the streets. And they say, oh, you need to wait. Or they tell us, why don't you vote at the election? And we tell them back, what do you think we have been doing all these years? We have been voting, but what do you have here? Two people that are responsible for the state of affairs in our country. You know, I was listening to the news about this activist, this brother, Darren Seals, that was shot. On Tuesday, his body appeared in a suburb of St. Louis. You know, days before, you know, this is the irony of this, the governor of Maine said, and as I will quote, you shoot at the enemy, you try to identify the enemy, and the enemy right now, the overwhelming majority right now are people of color. So this is the governor of Maine. Now you have a young organizer being shot, an African-American. So as a result of that, I think that on September 11, this coming Sunday, at 10:30 in the morning, we are going to join outside the federal building and 2020 Southwest 3rd Avenue in downtown Portland. We're going to come together. We're going to have Aztec dancers. We'll have music. But also, we are going to remember those that died in September 11. But what we have become as a country now, you know, in the racism and discrimination we are facing, many of us are facing in this state that we call Oregon and that we love. So that's some of the things that we'll be doing there. We'll be talking about what is happening with mass incarceration, police brutality, mass deportations. What we have done is people of color are faced with this. You know, probably I need to conclude and say that there is a poet and a performer that he said in a piece today that he's tired to be arguing with white folks about these issues. We don't have time anymore to do that so-called consciousness raising with white folks. You want to join us? Come. Don't come to question us, our motives, why we are doing this. Because this is not new. This is 500 years of history of slavery and discrimination towards indigenous people of the Americas and with African Americans. So join us. Sunday.
Yeah, give the time and the location one more time.
Yeah, it will be Sunday, September 11 at 10:30 a.m. at the Federal Building in 1220 Southwest 3rd Avenue in downtown Portland. And please come, bring signs, and we'll call it as a day of reflection, express our rage and atonement.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Francisco. That was Francisco Lopez of Voz Hispania Cambio Comunitario. Find out more about their work at www.vozhispania.org.
Yesterday, a federal judge issued a split ruling on the Standing Rock protest against the Dakota Access 1 pipeline across the Missouri River. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg ruling blocked continued construction of the pipeline on a stretch between Highway 1806 and a marker 20 miles east of Lake Oahe. However, construction is good to continue west of the highway because the judge said the U.S. Corps of Engineers have no jurisdiction on private land. The Standing Rock protesters had asked for a complete halt to construction based on federal law. KBOO's Chris Andres spoke this morning with Cody Hall at the Red Warrior Camp at Standing Rock.
Well, today it's a the mood is a little bit altered due to we got rainy skies, and it's been raining off and on throughout the day. But also yesterday a judge ruled in favor that construction can still proceed and still go on sacred burial sites. It's a very low blow to this whole system, this whole fight, because once we found out that they were desecrating the sacred burial sites, we took action to chase away the construction workers, which we did, but also they ended up pulling a fast one and on the people and desecrated these graves. They literally erased them from the history books and with no remorse. And so we're at a climb right now where, I mean, it's just, it's hard to fathom. I mean, really, just taking history and just, you know, just throwing it out to non-existence now. And yet people are wondering why we are taking a stand. You know, they're wondering why our plight as people right now. You know, we have our arms up. I mean, this is, this was a very low blow to the cause. And but like I said, it's not stopping us from defeating this pipeline. And it's just a there's going to be repercussions that will come from this that's going to far exceed the court system. And so, you know, we just have to stay vigilant with that with that idea, with those thoughts. But it is. It's a very low blow of what was done yesterday against law, against humanity. And like I said, they thought they brought us down, but what they really did was strengthen our cause and strengthen our fight right now. So,
what laws have they skirted so far that you know of?
They've pretty much went along every law and run amok on them. You know, regarding your civil rights. When we had dogs attack, you know, they put attack dogs on us on Saturday and violated our, you know, our civil rights. I mean, we're living in the 2016. We went back to the 1950s and 60s when people that hold themselves to a self-high degree of wearing a badge and a gun, or saying that they work now with, you know, private security, use attack dogs on people of color to try to subdue them, to try to bring them down. Really, it's an old tactic that I cannot believe that's still being used. And America seems to look at it, especially North Dakota. I mean, I call it the Mississippi of the North. People that are commenting on news feed that are saying that, and these are non-Native people. North Dakotans are saying that, hateful North Dakotans are saying that they wish that they would have just annihilated the Indians when they had a chance, you know, long ago. You know, they're saying it's okay to use attack dogs on protectors of the water, protectors of sacred sites. And they're just laughing at this whole humanity issue, like we do not exist. And like I said, this is North Dakota, 2016. It's the Mississippi of the North. And really, if you are somebody of color, your life is not worthy. Your life doesn't matter to the heads that be, to state and government officials, the FBI. The FBI, their office out of Bismarck, said that they did not see any wrongdoing that this private security firm used attack dogs on people.
That's,
they said that that there's no violation of that. There's nothing wrong with that.
The International Middle East Media Center reports the Green Party of Canada has adopted a policy of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel into its official platform. Despite pressure from pro-Israel lobby groups, supporters of the BDS resolution say they hope it will break down the stigma around using boycott, divestment, and sanctions to fight for Palestinian human rights. The move came after a hard-fought resolution successfully passed at the Green Party's annual convention over the weekend. Since its launch in 2005, over 170 Palestinian organizations have called on supporters to use boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Their objective is to pressure Israel to conform to international law, end discriminatory practices against its Palestinian citizens, and stop the occupation. The resolution also says that the Greens will oppose efforts to prohibit or punish support for BDS. Canada's parliament passed a non-binding resolution condemning BDS earlier this year.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Kitchen Table Conversations with Mary Postlewaite at 6 o'clock. And then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be warmer and sunnier, with highs near 74 degrees. Today in history, in 1916, the U.S. Congress passed the Workmen's Compensation Act, giving workers who are injured at work or who acquire an occupational disease the right to financial compensation. Also on this day in 1956, racial integration started at public schools in Washington, D.C. and in Maryland. Our quote of the day is from George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Progress is impossible without change, and those who cannot change their minds cannot change anything." The Leonard Peltier Freedom Ride series continues. The 3,000-mile bicycle ride for freedom traveled from Oregon to Washington, D.C. in July to seek the release of Leonard Peltier. Peltier was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in June of 1975. Many people, including former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, have argued that Peltier was not given a fair trial. KBOO's Delphine Crescenzo has more.
This is Chris Francisco reporting for KBOO from the Peltier Freedom Ride 2016. We are traveling from Banks, Oregon to Washington, D.C. from July 12th to the 24th to create awareness of the injustice Leonard Peltier has endured and support for his clemency. Thank you to all the people who have supported Leonard Peltier over the years.
The Peltier Justice Ride took off yesterday morning, Wednesday, July 13th, from Banks, Oregon, kicking off a 10-day journey to Washington, D.C. KBOO reporters Christopher Francisco and Brant Jorgensen were there to capture the opening words from Chauncey Peltier, one of the sons of Leonard Peltier, an organizer of the Peltier Justice Ride 2016.
Let's just pray we have a safe journey. Let's pray that everybody in the world sees this, it goes viral, and that's what Obama's asking for. So if we can make this, start a new tsunami and have this go viral and Obama sees it, that's what he's asking for. My cousin Carrie Ann was there last week, visited Leonard, said he was pretty good and pretty high in spirits. And under the stress and the situation, he's been pretty grumpy lately. But that's actually pretty good news. Any day we can get a good day out of him is good. You know? But 40 years of injustice, I can't blame him. I understand he's probably stressed and worried he's going to die in there. So, but anyways, we'll just have a good, safe journey. We won't be in no hurry.
KBOO's own Adam Carpinelli from the Prison Pipeline Collective was there in the morning to see the riders off.
We are at the kickoff event for a national tour, if you can call it that, of different vehicles, automobiles, and motorbikes that are headed from here in the Pacific Northwest. We are in Banks, Oregon. And folks are on their way to Washington, D.C. And there's this beautiful painting right here on one of the trucks that says Free Leonard Peltier. And it has the four directions on it and the beautiful painting of Leonard. So everybody cross country will see that. It says call the White House. And it has the phone number to call and all that. So this is a whole kind of consciousness raising event here.
The main focus of the Peltier Justice Ride 2016 is to make Leonard's case as visible as possible, as Adam Carpinelli described, with the hope that President Obama will be convinced that Leonard's case is important enough to be considered for clemency. In 2012, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Got to interview Leonard Peltier on the phone while at a news conference about his case. Here is Leonard, in his own words, describing why Obama should grant him clemency.
I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
Concerning what?
Your situation, or the situation in the world, or your own situation.
Stop all the wars, or what? What kind of message are you talking about?
You can share several messages.
Okay. Well, I just hope you can, stop the wars that are going on in the world and stop getting, killing all those people getting killed and, Give the Black Hills back to my people and turn me loose.
Can you share with people at the news conference and with President Obama your case for why you should be, your sentence should be commuted, why you want clemency?
Well, I never got a fair trial, for one. I mean, my case has been throttled from the moment they had grand jury hearings. They had somebody on the grand jury hearing testifying against that I'd never met in my life. And from the extradition from Canada, they violated international laws. And then at the trial, they had admitted race. At the trial, they had admitted races on the jury. They wouldn't allow me to put up a defense. And manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses. The list just goes on. So I think I'm a very good candidate for after 37 years for clemency or house arrest, at least.
What would house arrest mean? And can you describe your conditions in the prison in Florida where you are right now?
Supermax penitentiary, and that's like all the rest of penitentiaries. And house arrest would be that I'd be home at house arrest. I'd probably have to wear an anklet, a bracelet on my ankle, but that would be a lot better than this. At least I could get some medical treatment then. You know, I got a real bad prostate right now, and it's just getting worse and worse. It ain't getting any better. It isn't healing itself, so, just continue. thing is to grow better or worse.
My name is Brent Jorgensen.
So what's going on today?
We started out at Banks, Oregon, and had a rally there, which was really good. We had a prayer and prayed for our journey. We're on the journey to free Leonard Peltier in Washington, D.C. We went through Portland okay, and now we're about ready to enter Baker City. Along the way, we went to the Wild Horse Casino and went to the Umatilla Indian Reservation to see if we could find any more natives to join up with us or, you know, say how they think about Leonard. And then, we're about ready to call it an evening, set up camp tonight, get a good night's sleep, and head out tomorrow to Utah.
As Brent just described, the journey continues forward to Utah. Today, the caravan is driving through the state of Idaho and will rest tonight in the town of Rupert along Highway 84. Tune in again tomorrow to the KBOO Evening News to get an update from Christopher Francisco reporting from the Peltier Justice Ride 2016. For the KBOO Evening News, the segment was produced by Delphine Crescenzo and Christopher Francisco. Thank you for listening. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is upset about the number of refugee children in the world.
One of every 200 children in the world is a refugee. Enjoy your dinner tonight. One of every 200 children in the world is a refugee. Then find the most hilarious thing to watch on the TV. One of every 200 children in the world is a refugee. Or go where the music's so loud no one can talk. One of every 200 children in the world is a refugee. Good night. Sleep tight. Don't let the bed bugs bite. Can you get bed bugs when you don't have a bed? One of every 200 children in the world is a refugee, and how many million more children homeless in their own homelands? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
On August 30th, the U.S. Department of the Interior's Bureau of Land Management announced that it would utilize Congress's blessing given to it in the form of past legislation to proceed with online bidding for oil and gas located on U.S. public lands. The industry push to make online bidding the norm, as opposed to standard in-person oral bidding, began with a feverish pitch in 2009 in reaction to the Bitter 70 civil disobedience action of activist Tom DeChristopher at an auction in Utah. It culminated 7 years later in reaction to another movement, this one involving the U.S. environmental movement at large and not just a single person, otherwise known as the Keep It in the Ground campaign.
Zimbabwe. My leasing is that it's been a long haul push by the oil and gas industry. Have documented that they've been lobbying on it for about a decade, long before the Keep It in the Ground movement existed, long before Tim DeChristopher did his civil disobedience action, in which he showed up at a lease in Utah and got arrested for posing as someone in the industry when he was an activist and went to jail for doing so. The industry cites these two movements, you know, DeChristopher and the Keep It in the Ground movement, as reasons for the need for online auctions to, quote-unquote, end the circus of protests outside of these leases. But it's been a push for a long time. The deeper story is that one particular company named EnergyNet, whose lobbyist is named Tim Stewart. He is the brother of United States Senator Chris Stewart in Utah. He is the brother of a U.S. judge, a federal judge named Ted Stewart, and his nephew is a high-ranking energy aide for Utah's Governor Gary Herbert, so they're very connected in Utah. The long story is that he is a lobbyist for one of the industry-funded groups that's pushing this, Western Energy Alliance. He's also a lobbyist for EnergyNet, and he's been lobbying on this issue for about a decade. And so we are now seeing that realized because of this Obama administration announcement. And a lot of that has to do with backlash against the Keep It in the Ground movement that's pushing to end leases of, especially very cheap leases of public land parcels for oil and gas drilling. And so that's sort of a long story short of it. I think right now it's not over yet, though. We're also seeing the very same identical pushes. That was for onshore leasing. Offshore, we're seeing the same push. There's a bill moving through Congress that we'll see action this week, House Resolution 5577, which does the same thing for offshore drilling. Also has support of the Obama administration. So this will be a key part of President Obama's legacy. If we have these leases that were once open to the public being moved completely to online, it'll be, first, an erosion of democracy, but second, it's just, he enriched, it privatized the whole process and enriching one particular company that is actually, very connected with elite Republican Party circles in the state of Utah.
So this is yet another effort to privatize, in the name of privatization, everything that Obama will leave in his, more like his wake and then his legacy. So if people can no longer protest in person, as they have an absolute right to do, quickly at the very last minute, how do we protest the online auctions?
I think that it's not permanent. They have said that it looks like it will be this way for the foreseeable future, but I think a lot of environmental NGOs aren't happy about this, and if there's a loud enough noise, maybe that won't take place. It's still kind of it's not an issue that's really reached mainstream sort of media or anger.
But this show ends. But this is where your opportunity right now to take action on this, and in fact, protest the online auctions. That's where it starts. Keep it in the ground. This has been Cascadia for Tuesday, September 5th. Janet Anderson, engineer of the show. Kathleen Stevenson, KBOAM News, Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your right. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Just to reiterate, that was journalist Steve Horn speaking earlier on Air Cascadia with host Chris Andre.
Zimbabwe's High Court has declared that a recent ban on protests is unconstitutional, overturning a Robert Mugabe-led move to stifle dissent in the country. FSRN's Garikai Chanza reports from Harare.
Opposition parties and human rights activists are hailing the decision by High Court Justice Priscilla Chigumba. The ruling comes on the heels of a lightly veiled threat from President Robert Mugabe, who said Saturday that judges, I quote, dare not be negligent in their decisions, close quote, on legal challenges to a two-week ban on public protests in the country. Amid widespread revolt, late last week the government invoked the prohibition on protest. The move came after a coalition of political parties called the National Electoral Reform Agenda, or NERA, reapplied for a permit to demonstrate in central Harare last Friday. Until a few years ago, public protest in the country was rare because the nation's constitution included strict rules for public gatherings and demonstrations. But those rules were tossed out when voters approved a new constitution in 2013. Tendai Biti, the attorney representing NERA, told reporters outside the court that the judgment shows the independence of the judiciary.
The court spelled out the fundamental issues as defined in the Constitution, namely that we are in a constitutional democracy and that the courts are independent and they operate without fear and favor. And in that breath, the court proceeded to hand down a very brief judgment in favor of liberty, in favor of the freedoms that are enshrined in the Constitution.
Since May, Zimbabwe has seen a series of escalating protests with people expressing anger at President Robert Mugabe. They say he is ruining the country that's now crippled by a cash crunch and labor crisis. Mugabe has reacted by unleashing armed police details to beat up and arrest peaceful protesters. In recent weeks, hundreds of thousands of dollars of property has been damaged as civilians fight back against the repression. Justice Chigumba stayed her order for 7 days to allow the government a chance to appeal. Garikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
We'll be right back. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Joe Lino, Ray Bodwell, Chris Andre, and Martin Dodge. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, talk radio host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Daniel Lukow from Common Cause Oregon about Commissioner Fritz's proposal for public financing of campaigns. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio. At 11, on Between the Covers, the guest writer is Hope Jahren, who talks about her memoir of her life in science called Lab Girl. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is Oregon artist Maximilian Uriarte, who talks about his new graphic novel, The White Donkey. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now